a little time to this most unusual book. Not many people study this. The Lamentations of Jeremiah. If you find Psalms and Proverbs in Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, and we're at chapter 2. Now, I'm very aware of the fact that since we started this book of the Lamentations of Jeremiah, there have been ever so many interruptions. I've been away on holiday and for various other things. Well, we're doing Lamentations this week. Next week it'll be Colin Sinclair and Festus Nkongi. Then we'll have a Saturday on Lamentation. Then I think it'll be the first Saturday of the month. And it's difficult. And I really don't want always to be reviewing what we've been saying. But just by way of introduction, we're at chapter 2, but we keep in mind that the historical context of this book is the collapse of Jerusalem, when the whole of the land of Israel was overrun by its enemies. The city of Jerusalem collapsed and really was ruined, and the Jews were carried away captive into Babylon. And they had been told by God through the prophet Jeremiah that this is what was going to happen, and that they would serve a captivity for 70 years. Almost as if God was saying, now there is a very important lesson that you, the people of God, have to learn, and it's going to take you 70 years to learn it. And if the older generation had said, well, but we'll be dead and gone by then, I think the good Lord would have said, that's because you've refused to learn, and now you're past learning, and you've lost your opportunity. And the message of this book, Lamentations, is essentially a call to the people of God, or a help to the people of God, so that they can contrast what they once were as the people of God. What they could have become under the gracious providence of God as the people of God. Here's the contrast. What they once were, what they could have become under God if they had walked in obedience, and what they now are. A people in disobedience, under discipline, and rejected in measure, and certainly taken out of the work. Now that's quite a solemn thought. But the message in these few chapters of Lamentations is a message to the people of God, who, in spite of all God's blessings over many years, let's apply it, in spite of all God's blessings over many years, and in spite of all the privileges accorded to them by God over many years, they had failed personally, and they had failed in respect of the work of God. Oh, you say, preacher, that makes the Lamentations of Jeremiah a very gloomy book. Yes, that's true, but for the fact that at the heart of the book, and this is why we sang, come let us to the Lord our God with contrite heart, and our God is gracious, nor will leave the desolate to mourn. At the heart of the book that we call the Lamentations of Jeremiah, we have in chapter 3, at verse 22, the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. Does that mean even when we make the most awful mess of things? Exactly. Even if we've been totally disobedient, does this still apply? Yes, it still applies. That's why I like the Lamentations of Jeremiah. Our hearts, if God we seek to know, shall know him and rejoice. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. And in response to that we read, the Lord is my portion, says my soul, therefore I will hope in him. That's the captives in Babylon. They're in disgrace. But they say, because that is my God, and because he is my God, and because his steadfast love endures forever, I will hope in him. And that's the story, really, of the whole of the Lamentations of Jeremiah. We've already studied in detail the whole of chapter 1. And all I would mention about chapter 1 is verse 21 and the second half of the verse. All my enemies have heard of my trouble, and they are glad that thou hast done it. You see, this is the awful thing about when Christians fail. The godless are glad when the church is distressed. Sometimes when I see things in newspapers about all the predicament of the church, whether the denomination or individual churches and broken down churches and the constant bleating about lack of money and lack of attendance and this and that and the other thing, I grieve because I can imagine godless folk reading the papers and having a jolly good laugh. All my enemies have heard of my trouble. They are glad that thou hast done it. And so we come to chapter 2. How the Lord in his anger has set the daughter of Zion under a cloud. It doesn't say that God has abandoned his people. It doesn't say that God has no longer any desire for fellowship with his people. But there is a cloud. You know what it's like when there's a cloud between friends. Or for that matter, when there's a cloud between a husband and a wife. Things are not the same. Well, that's what's being spoken about here. The Lord in his anger has set the daughter of Zion under a cloud. He has cast down from heaven to earth the splendor of Israel. He has not remembered his footstool in the day of his anger. We'll come to the details in a moment, but notice as we read through verses 1 to 9, notice how often it says, he, God. Now, none of this is accidental. None of this is ultimately to be explained in terms of the wicked things that an enemy has done. This is God. He has cast down from heaven to earth the splendor of Israel. He has not remembered his footstool in the day of his anger. The Lord has destroyed without mercy all the habitations of Jacob. In his wrath, he has broken down the stronghold, that is the fortresses of the daughter of Judah, that is of the city of Jerusalem. He has brought down to the ground in dishonor the kingdom, and it's not just the fortresses and the defenses and the walls of Jerusalem and the buildings. God has brought down the government. the kingdom and its rulers. He has cut down in fierce anger the might of Israel. He has withdrawn from them his right hand. Now it says in the Bible that God is the defense of his people. Oh no, no, says God, I've contracted out. He has withdrawn from them his right hand in the face of the enemy. He has burned like a flaming fire in Jacob, consuming all around. He has bent his bow like an enemy, with his right hand set like a foe. And he has slain the pride of our eyes in the tent of the daughter of Zion. He has poured out his fury like fire. The Lord has become like an enemy. He has destroyed Israel. He has destroyed all its palaces, laid in ruin its stronghold. And he has multiplied in the daughter of Judah mourning and lamentation. He has broken down his booth like that of a garden, laid in ruins the place of his appointed feasts. The Lord has brought to an end in Zion The Lord has brought to an end in Zion appointed feasts. The feast and Sabbath, that is, the Lord has brought to an end religious ordinances. God has brought to an end all the church services throughout the length and breadth of the country. Now, we naturally tend to say, the Lord wouldn't do that now. But then that's exactly what the Jews said. The prophets warned them that God would do this and send a famine of the word and send them into captivity. But they said, the Lord wouldn't do that to the heart of the nation, to Jerusalem. But God did. Now, I don't know how you can grasp or how you feel about the thought of a nation in which all the church services had been stopped. Think of places like Albania. Religion has just been blotted out. The Lord has brought to an end in Zion appointed feast and Sabbath, and in his fierce indignation has spurned king and priest. The Lord has scorned his own altar, and disowned his sanctuary. Can I put it as vividly as possible? That's God standing out in Kelvinhaugh Street and pointing to this church and said, I'm no longer associated with that place. Hardly bears thinking about, does it? The Lord has disowned his sanctuary. He has delivered into the hand of the enemy the walls of her palaces. A clamor was raised in the house of the Lord on the day of an appointed feast. The Lord determined to lay in ruins the wall of the daughter of Zion, that is, the city of Jerusalem. I've written in the margin of my Bible, but it was the army of Babylon that destroyed Jerusalem. Ah, no, no, says God, they were just the instrument. I gave the orders. He marked it off by the line. He retained not his hand from destroying. He caused rampart and wall to lament. They languished together. Her gates are sunk into the ground. He has ruined and broken her bars. Her king and princes are among the nations. The law is no more. Now put it into our own contemporary language. The Bible is no more. How would you react if you went into any of the bookshops in town and said you wanted to buy a Bible? And they said, a Bible? What do you mean, a Bible? No book of that name. That's what happened in China. The Bibles were burned. Remember, we told the children once of this Chinese pastor who had memorized the whole of the New Testament. I still can't quite remember all of John chapter 14, which I learned at school. What would we do? Do you see the significance of what the psalmist says? Thy word have I hid in my heart. I think it's very sad nowadays that memorizing has become discredited in the whole world of education and in the realm of the church. I don't know why it is, but I sometimes wonder if I end up in exile or in prison for Christ's sake or something like that without my Bible, how much of it would I be able to recite to myself in a prison cell? Oh, I know there are individual verses. I know there are passages. Passages like Jeremiah 29:11. I know the thoughts I have towards you, thoughts of grace to give you a future. I think I could remember quite a lot of Paul's letter to the Philippians. Rejoice in the Lord always. And again I say, rejoice. I think I could remember quite a lot of Romans chapter 5, especially the first half, and most of Romans chapter 8. But look, my friends, we've been sitting under biblical ministry for years and years and years and years. Now, to what extent have we stored up the word in our minds and in our hearts? I remember being very cross once. I think it was at a conference somewhere, and somebody said to me, and it was a discussion, and they said, Mr. Lewis, isn't there a verse somewhere in the Bible that says something like... Oh, they got it all wrong. I think that's sad. And I must confess that I'm immensely glad that I was brought up in the Authorized Version, because it is far more easy to memorize than the more modern versions. That's just a fact. The law is no more, and her prophets obtain no vision from the Lord. I remember once in the early days of my ministry, within the first 5 years, my bachelor days, and my brother was staying with me that particular weekend. He was on holiday. And I remember getting up very early in the Sunday morning. I was sitting at my desk, and I'd reached the stage of tears because I felt I had no word to preach to the people that morning. Oh, there was the passage in front of me, but it seemed to be lifeless. Now, I can understand how the prophets would feel if they had no vision from the Lord. Now, you try to think of how you would feel. It won't happen tomorrow morning, because sermon notes are all in the back of my Bible. But you imagine what it would be tomorrow morning if, say, after the intercessory prayer and the uplifting of the offering and the dedicating of the offering, we sang another hymn, and then I said to you, God has no message for us this day. Now that's what we're reading about here. The law is no more, and her prophets obtain no vision from the Lord. Now, a few words of comment about these first 9 verses, which I think we've tried to elaborate as we've read them. It is the Lord's doing. God seems to take the place here of the enemy against his people. And as I said before we read the passage, you go through the passage on your own and underline that little word, he. And when you look down to verse 8, the Lord determined. That is, it was the clear, deliberate decision of God to bring Jerusalem down and to lead his people away into captivity. You look at the first two verses of the chapter. In verses 1 and 2, especially verse 1, he has cast down from heaven to earth the splendor of Israel. That's a reference to the temple, because it was a magnificent temple. And oh, how proud the Jews were of their temple. Think of how people who have visitors coming to this country, perhaps down in London, and you take them to see the Houses of Parliament. Well, that's something worth seeing, outside and inside. Well, they did that to the temple. And Jewish parents going up to Jerusalem for the feast, they would make a point of telling their children, now we'll see the temple, God's house, and they would take them round all the courtyards of the temple and into the various colonnades and all that kind of thing to show them the glory, the splendor of the temple. And God cast down from heaven to earth the splendor of his temple. He has not remembered his footstool. The commentators tell me to look up 1 Chronicles chapter 28 verse 2, where the Ark of the Covenant is referred to as God's footstool. He has not remembered his footstool. Not even the most central, most sacred part of the temple escaped this judgment by God. When we come down to verse 3, in the middle of the verse, he has withdrawn from them his right hand. That is, God has withdrawn what some of the commentators call the restraints of common grace. Not sure that I like the phrase common grace as opposed to saving grace. But for lack of a better phrase, think of God's common grace. Think how much is kept in subjection. Think of how much evil there is that is not allowed to erupt. Think of how many dangers are not in fact allowed to impinge upon us. At the end of any given day, I could imagine God the Father speaking to God the Son in the glory of their heavenly home, and looking down and saying, I wonder if that man Philip knows just how much we have kept from him today. I may have gone through the day thinking, well, that was a remarkably calm day. Nothing to ruffle, nothing to disturb, no complications, no difficulties. Unaware of the fact that God has kept back that which would have disturbed or harmed me. And therefore I can understand this verse in a very vivid way. The middle of verse 3, if God withdraws from his people that right hand, that protecting grace. I don't think any of us have any real understanding of how much we owe. Think of Murray McChain's hymn, Not Till Then. Speaking about only when we get to glory. Not till then, Lord, shall I know. Not till then, how much I owe. And so we come down to verse 6. He has broken down his booth like that of a garden, laid in ruins the place of his appointed feasts. The Lord has brought to an end in Zion appointed feast and Sabbath and has spurned both king and priest. That's just a verse which in contemporary terms speaks of God demolishing the church. And I and not a few others feel that this is in measure what God is doing to our own denomination, the Church of Scotland, in the present decade. I think he's cutting us down to size. It's not all that long since it was boasted at the General Assembly. Oh, let them criticize. We have more than 1 million members. Well, it's down 200,000 now. And even presbyteries and assemblies are acknowledging that out of the 800,000 members that we have, a very high percentage of the membership never goes to church. And I think our denomination is being forced to come to terms with reality and to face up to the truth of its own condition. There was issued in the Presbytery Minutes last month various statistics, financial statistics, and among them a note of what they call the per capita givings, givings per head of membership, because that doesn't allow for people who never come. But you know, to read down the list and to see that in some of the affluent areas of our city, average giving per member per year, £47. £34. And this is what our denomination is being compelled to face up to. And God is in it. Notice I say that it is a picture of God demolishing, not destroying, the church. Jesus said, "On this rock will I build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." But demolishing in the sense of stripping down to basic reality. Even in such simple areas as this, that to a tremendous extent, in all that we mean by the inner areas of our cities, not just the heart of the city, but the inner areas of our cities, most of the churches have been closed down. But now we're finding a situation in Glasgow and in other cities that the movement of population is from the way out in the perimeter of the cities and the housing schemes back towards the centre of the cities, and houses, warehouses, all sorts of things are being reconstructed to become dwelling places. But all the churches are gone. I wonder why. There was a debate in Presbytery on Tuesday about uniting congregations and all that kind of thing. And the convener pointed out that on the south side, that is the river side of Argyle Street, between St. Vincent Street and Scotstoun, there are only three churches. Sandyford, Partick South, and White Inch. And that whole stretch of the city. Why I ask that we should pray for the church and for all the administration of the church. We spoke about it last Sunday evening, didn't we? About praying for those who are in places of rule and authority and government. Not just in the secular realm, but in church realm. put it like this. It's been done sometimes at the prayer meeting, but in our own private prayers at home, when did you last pray and ask God to bless the meetings of the assembly committees that meet from time to time in the church offices in 121 George Street in Edinburgh? It's important. That's where decisions are made. And I've asked you before to pray about presbytery, and I believe you are doing. Look at verse 7, the beginning of the verse 7. The Lord has scorned his altar and disowned his sanctuary. He has disowned the whole religious life of the nation. Remember the story at the beginning of the first book of Samuel? And that awful word, Ichabod, the glory has departed. There's a story, it's fiction, but it was current amongst the Jewish people in the early days, that shortly before AD 70, before Jerusalem was destroyed, and it hasn't really been rebuilt properly until now, there was a story that those around the city and near the temple heard a noise as if it was a breath of wind moving away from the temple. The Lord has disowned his sanctuary. And we've already mentioned about verse 9, the second half of the verse, the law and the prophets no more, the word of God and the voice of God gone. No vision. And when I read that last line of verse 9, I thought of the verse, where there is no vision, the people perish. I think we've just time to read verses 10 to 13. I had hoped to go right through the chapter tonight, believe it or not. Verse 10, the elders of the daughter of Zion sit on the ground in silence. They have cast dust on their heads and put on sackcloth. The maidens of Jerusalem have bowed their heads to the ground. My eyes, said Jeremiah. Remember when we started Lamentations, we looked up the verse in Jeremiah. Oh, that my head were a fountain of tears, that I might weep for the heart of my people. I wonder if we felt like weeping for our own national church, as I was speaking earlier on, just a few moments ago. Or were we rather critical? My eyes are spent with weeping. My soul is in tumult. My heart is poured out in grief because of the destruction of the daughter of my people, because infants and babes faint in the streets of the city. They cry to their mothers, where is bread and wine? As they faint like wounded men in the streets of the city, as their life is poured out on their mother's bosom. What can I say for you? To what can I compare you? O daughter of Jerusalem, what can I liken to you that I may comfort you? O virgin daughter of Zion. Oh, says God through the prophet, that's how I think of you. My redeemed, blood-washed people. O virgin daughter of Zion, for vast as the sea is your ruin, who can restore you? All I want to say about these three verses tonight, was it 4, verse 10, 11, 12, 13, is that they show to us something of the sadness of the prophet. And the prophet's sadness reflects the sorrow of God, of whom it is said in Scripture that God has no pleasure in the death of the wicked. And God has certainly no pleasure in the sufferings of his own people. Oh, what a heart God has. I suppose every parent who has ever chastised a child, knowing that the chastisement was necessary and that it was right, still feels that awful feeling in your heart when you look at the tear-stained face of a child so precious to you. Well, that's how God feels about us when he has to rebuke us or chasten us or deal with us sternly. I suppose there's a bit in these verses that indicate especially about the state of the infants and the babies. There is some reference to very real distress, no doubt caused by famine. And there may or may not have been relief agencies, I don't know. But the fact remains that sin brings disaster, and disaster involves the innocent children. We haven't time to look up references. Or maybe we could, just to finish with Luke chapter 13. Luke chapter 13, we've got to be very careful about that statement I've just made, that sin brings disaster. We've got to be careful about how we deal with the cause and effect. Look what Jesus says in Luke chapter 13 at verse 1. There were some present at that time who told Jesus of the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. And Jesus answered them, "Do you think, or are you suggesting that these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered thus? I tell you no. But unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. Or those 18 upon whom the tower in Siloam fell and killed them." You know, that was a disaster, like some of our helicopter and train and aeroplane disasters, that kind of thing. "These 18 upon whom the tower in Siloam fell and killed them, do you think that they were worse offenders than all the others who dwelt in Jerusalem? I tell you, no. You can't attach the disaster to the specific individual sins of those who are hurt by it. But unless you repent, you will all likewise perish." But turn back to Luke chapter 11. At verse 49. "Therefore also the wisdom of God said, I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill and persecute, that the blood of all the prophets shed from the foundation of the world may be required of this generation." There's a build-up, you see. From the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah, who perished between the altar and the sanctuary, yes, I tell you, it shall be required of this generation. And as we close our Bibles and Lamentations for tonight, remember what it says at the end of the second book of Chronicles, how God sent to the people his prophets, again and again, year after year, decade after decade, generation after generation, and how God both pleaded and warned his people, and they wouldn't take any notice until there was no remedy and the decision was taken by God. And what we read about tonight came to pass. But I'm glad that we read right at the beginning, the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. Therefore, I will hope in him. Found myself thinking earlier on today about the hymn that says, in the cross of Christ I glory, towering o'er the wrecks of time. Let's sing about the message of that cross. In the hymn number 5.